White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is White Aryan Resistance, and this is Terrible Tommy here in the bunker right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station. And that's right next to our weapons of mass destruction, used equipment, and refurbished weapons of mass destruction, of which we're trying to figure out how we're going to airlift this out of this state and get it where we want to go. And I've been working on that for weeks. I brought some of the top Chinese communist scientists in here to figure it out. I think they'll probably figure it out. Hopefully, because we got a lot of equipment out there to move. I'm telling you. We have to move it without the feds seeing us move it. Now, that's going to be strange. However, I doubt whether it'd be that much trouble. We just paint different insignias on them, you know. Put the Israeli Star David on them, and we could drive them right down the freeway, no problem. But I've been boxing and tubbing and moving, and, oh, I'm telling you, my back hurts. Now it's okay today. Don't get excited. I'm okay. You know, some of you people out there I know are dumpster divers. Maybe all of you are. I've always had a good time looking around for stuff, sitting on a street corner or in a dumpster, and sometimes you find some really interesting things. Sometimes you find really interesting things. Sometimes you find things you didn't want to find. But our politics is a lot like that. You know, you can't trust the right-wing neocons, even a hell of a lot of racial right-wingers. You can't. And the Jewish left, that's a big problem. There are hardly any real liberals left that you could count on to tell the truth. So it's difficult. Well, so once in a while, I'll play stuff or put stuff on a website that you say, what the hell did he put that on there for? Well, because there was truth in it. Now, there may have been lies mixed up in it, too, but there's truth, and I depend on you people having the brains to sort it out. Instead of coming back to me, you know that thing you put on there? You hear that? What that one guy said? I say, well, look, yeah, but look at the good stuff he said. That's what you're supposed to be doing. You're like a miner mining for gold. You're picking away, and most of it's crap, but every once in a while you might run into a nugget of gold. The following is, what's his name? I've got a little show from Chris Hedges on RT, Russia TV. Now, Hedges is a real left-wing liberal. And on most things, or a lot of things, I disagree vehemently. In fact, it was either I or John Metzger that was on his television show, and he was giving us a real hard time about 20 years ago. But on the other hand, sometimes he comes out with something damn good, and we should not throw the baby out with the bathwater, as far as I'm concerned. And he's going to talk about this stranglehold this corrupt, lying media has on this country. And he's got a guest on there that's written a book about it. Now, if you're a big Trump lover, you're not going to be real happy with these guys. But I got to admit, I'm not a real Trump lover. I like some of the things he says, sort of excites me a little bit, but beyond that, I don't trust him any more than I would anybody else, especially a billionaire. Sorry, boys. Anyhow, here we go. Here is Chris Hedges.
Welcome to On Contact. Today we discuss how Star became our president with the journalist and author Matt Taibbi.
He was sort of a perfect storm for the TV format that is the campaign show.
On Contact with Chris Hedges. Celebrity culture has leached into every aspect of our society, including politics, to bequeath to us what Benjamin DeMott called junk politics. Junk politics does not demand justice or the reparation of rights. It miniaturizes large, complex problems at home while maximizing threats from abroad. It's also given to abrupt, unexplained reversals of its own public stances, often spectacularly bloating problems previously miniaturized. And finally, it seeks at every turn to obliterate voters' consciousness of socioeconomic and other differences in their midst. An image-based culture, one dominated by junk politics, communicates through narratives, pictures, and carefully orchestrated spectacle, as well as manufactured pseudo-drama. Kings, queens, and emperors once used their court conspiracies to divert their subjects. Today, cinematic, political, and journalistic celebrities distract us with their personal foibles, outrageous statements, and scandals. Theater and politics, as was true during the reign of Nero, have merged and become interchangeable. This decayed system gave us Donald Trump. RT correspondent Anya Parampel looks at some of the more bizarre moments in the 2016 presidential election.
The 2016 primary and election season was unprecedented for many reasons, and sometimes it reached unprecedented levels of straight-up absurdity. Like, for example, did you know a notorious serial killer was running for the Republican nomination? At least according to the now infamous meme suggesting Texas Senator Ted Cruz committed the Zodiac murders of Northern California in the late 60s and early 70s. Never mind the fact Cruz was born in 1970, 2 years after the first murder took place. But that wasn't the only theory to hit Cruz. In July, his rival Donald Trump, who repeatedly referred to the Texas senator as Lion Ted, attempted to tie his father, Raphael, to JFK's assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald. Here's what Trump had told Fox News just a few months before.
You know, his father was with Lee Harvey Oswald prior to Oswald being, shot. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. What is this, right prior to his being shot? And nobody even brings it up. I mean, they don't even talk about that.
Trump apparently based this accusation on a photo published on the front page of the National Enquirer, showing the two men passing out pro-Fidel Castro pamphlets in New Orleans. But as history tells us, Rafael Cruz, now 77 years old, was not part of any plot to assassinate President Kennedy. But the craziness wasn't only confined to Cruz. GOP hopeful U.S. Senator Rand Paul had his own strange moment. Kind of speaks for itself. Then there was the bizarre tale of Ben Carson, who opened up on the campaign trail about his troubled past, including that time he tried to stab a friend at 14 years old.
When I was a youngster, when I was a teenager, 14? I almost stabbed someone. Had it not been for a belt buckle under their clothing, they would have been killed or seriously injured.
The story quickly fell apart, but Carson didn't back down, insisting at one point in his life he did try to kill someone as a young boy. These moments and more resulted in one of the most bizarre election seasons in recent memory.
Thank you, Anya. Matt Taibbi is one of the finest writers and reporters in America. He writes for Rolling Stone and is the author of The Divide, Griftopia, and The Great Derangement. He lifts up the voices and experiences that have been rendered invisible. He fearlessly excoriates the powerful for their lies and ruthless exploitation of the vulnerable. And he does so with a rapier-like humor and satire. His latest book is Insane Clown President. Matt.
How's it going, Chris?
It's a wonderful book.
Good to see you.
Everything you write is wonderful. Yes.
Thanks.
I say that. You've ruined many weeks of my life. I finish your book. Anyway. Let's talk about the system.
Sure.
You do some... It's a wonderful book in terms of explaining why we have Trump. Mm-hmm. Both in terms of the system that created Trump, I thought there were some amazing points, which we'll get into on TV culture and stuff. But let's start where, and this is a passage from your book, you said, every mechanism our mighty oligarchy has devised to keep people like Trump out of power failed. Mm-hmm. What was the failure?
Well, the way I saw it, and this is from years of covering campaigns, it was really like a tripartite system that's designed to keep outsiders from doing what Trump did. And you have to have the assent of the press, the sort of the donor class, and then one of the two political parties to get in. And it's kind of an exclusive club, and it's sort of like a membership system. They all have to agree and confer their blessing on the candidate. And Trump, you know, somehow managed to get past all three of those obstacles, and he did it essentially by putting all of them on trial. He made them, he put the process on trial and villainized them with the public, and that was, I think it was a brilliant kind of masterstroke that nobody saw coming, but it wouldn't have been possible if their unpopularity had not been building for years and years and years.
You talk about the press, you call it, there were a couple lines in there I loved. You talked about the campaign press as a roving prison.
Well, you know.
Because you're behind the rope line, and then you're on a plane, and then you're behind, you don't actually talk to real people. But you also talk about the press as being the guardians of the orthodoxy of the elites.
Right.
Explain how that works.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you're familiar with this.
Yeah,
well, yeah, of course.
I'll let you explain.
the press is a very clubby, gossipy kind of priesthood, and particularly with this one assignment, the campaign trail, it's concentrated. All the worst instincts of the media become worse in this environment.
Well, as you point out in the book, they identify
right
with the elite and adopt the disdain of the elite
right
towards the public.
Exactly. And what it's a kind of Stockholm syndrome, because of what you talked about before, the reporters and the candidates and the candidates' aides, they're all thrown together. They're stuck in the same environment with each other for day after day, week after week, month after month. And after a while, they start to just unconsciously adopt each other's values. And then what happens is that culturally, they start to live in the same neighborhoods. They start to go to the same parties. And then it becomes a year after year kind of a thing. And then you know what happens after that. They're the same people.
They're courtiers.
Right, exactly. And so, it's a total perversion of what is supposed to happen. You know, we're supposed to be on the outside, not identifying with these people. And now it's a club, and journalists enjoy the experience of being close to power, which is the opposite of what it's supposed to be.
You talk about, I thought it was brilliant, that you talk about the mechanisms that at a certain moment when the establishment decides that a particular candidate has to be demolished, you brought up Dean. The press has three mechanisms by which they're unleashed. You called it, first they force the abashed public apology, then you have the period of the short dead man walking period, and then you have the anticlimactic withdrawal.
Right.
Explain how that works, and then explain to me why it didn't work on Trump.
So I was joking about this with a reporter whose name I don't even remember. We were talking in Iowa about this thing, and he called it the seal of death.
Right, you did that in the book, right?
Yeah. And basically, it's a script that we always follow, and whether unconsciously or consciously, you know, when a candidate steps in it, makes a mistake. Howard Dean is the classic example. And violates the orthodoxy.
We're talking about the scream that he did.
The scream,
then
right.
They replay every hour.
Every hour,
right.
You know, 100 times a day
right,
it's played. But a crucial part of that is that Dean was already in violation leading up to that moment. He was not the right person. It could be because he was anti-war, because he got his donations from the wrong people. He makes the mistake. The press pigpiles on the person just instinctively. This is what they do. There's all this negative attention. The candidate immediately freaks out, apologizes.
That's the short dead man walking period.
Yeah, and then disappears for a while, tries to soldier on.
Kind of like Ben Carson. Right?
Exactly, yeah. And then, you know, next thing you know, it's a page 16 story. Candidate exits the race. I mean, it's a script. I mean, but it didn't work with Trump.
That's the question, why?
They tried it over and over again. You know, it started really with the McCain thing when he called him, you know, I prefer people who aren't captured. But Trump was resistant to it. I think what happened was that people were waiting for somebody to defy this instinct. They resent the idea that the press gets to choose who gets to run for president and who doesn't. And I think it was just a convergence of a number of factors. I mean, I don't know. What do you think? Why did it work in that moment? I just think
because I think the press has lost as much credibility as the two major parties. I think we deserve all the hatred we get.
Right.
And you, later on in the book, I read your book too. I guess you forgot. But you write, what we call right-wing and liberal media in this country are really just two different strategies of the same kind of nihilistic lizard brain sensationalism. The ideal CNN story is a baby down a well, while the ideal Fox story is probably a baby thrown down a well by a Muslim terrorist or an acorn activist. Both companies offer the same service. It's just that the Fox version is a little kinkier.
Right, yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah, exactly. It's capitalism. It's a consumer product that you're buying, right? And you're buying an experience when you tune into these news programs. And one of them is a little bit more respectable than the other, right? But there's no difference really between them. I think what happens is when you work in that environment for long enough, you just unconsciously become an agent of whatever that commercial strategy is. And what happened with Trump was that, as you say, they became so unpopular that when they tried this on him, it had the reverse effect.
Right.
It actually increased his popularity.
You must have found it fascinating, too. I was watching these cable news shows, and they were using adjectives about Trump that they would never be allowed to use against. I mean, it was absolutely full-throttled assault.
Right. Yeah, once they turned a corner on him somewhere, I would say, around, I don't know, what, December, January, and they realized that they had been a little bit complicit in this phenomenon.
Well, I think you put in the book, he got 23 times the television coverage of Sanders.
That's exactly right. And they tried, I think, to make up for it by going negative on him, but it didn't help. It did the opposite. It proved what Steve Bannon was saying.
It was kind of like Mitt Romney denouncing him.
Yeah, exactly. It was a boon, or Goldman Sachs for that matter. You know, when they came out, or the news story came out that they had banned their executives from donating to Trump, well, Trump was proud of that,
right? That's a gift.
Theoretically, right?
Thanks. So. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Matt Taibbi, author of Insane. Let's get back to our conversation with Matt Taibbi, author of Insane Clown President. In the book, you call Trump a TV believer. What do you mean by that?
Now it's funny, people have this idea that Trump has no connection to the quote-unquote common man, but he does. He has exactly the same media habits that ordinary people have, and he believes the stuff that he reads on the Internet and watches on television implicitly and unquestioningly. And that is what gives him that connection with people, because he thinks like they do. He has the same habits that they have. A classic example is this thing with the 3 million so-called illegal immigrant voters. And he reads that probably in an InfoWars story, and it's policy like 2 minutes later because he doesn't go through the process of asking himself if it's untrue. He's a perfect consumer in that respect, and that's what makes him so dangerous.
You write at one point that Bush was just an appetizer and Trump would be the main course, which I thought you're dead on. But explain that idea.
Well, so Bush, we had to go through the experience of electing somebody who was wholly and openly unqualified.
Stupid.
Yeah, for the office.
Let's not mince words.
Yeah,
here.
Exactly. I mean, I remember hearing the story about how Bush carried around a biography of Dean Acheson for months and months and months so that he could signal to reporters that he knew how to read.
Well, you have some great Bush quotes in there.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't write them down.
I mean, we all almost miss Bush, actually, because he was so funny. But Bush was child's play compared to what we're dealing with now, because Bush was a puppet. He was a vehicle for a very familiar form of right-wing capitalist politics. And this Trump thing is totally different, because Trump really is the actual engine behind this phenomenon. And, the entire campaign, there were no people behind the man, I don't think. I think it really was just a couple of overheated ganglia behind his eyes.
And yet, he's a reality television star who understands the medium, and you write that his innovation was to recognize what a bad TV show the campaign was. Any program that tried to make stars out of human sedatives like Scott Walker and Lindsey Graham needed new producers and a new script. And so in terms of playing the part within the reality television show that is political campaigning, he was kind of brilliant. I mean, he understood it. Absolutely. On the other hand, he can't govern.
No, but those are two completely different things. And again, that's the flaw in our system, is that the presidential election campaign has no relation to the issue of whether or not you can govern effectively. The campaign is a television show. The values that decide whether or not a person becomes the candidate or doesn't become the candidate are all, they're more or less completely arbitrary. They have a lot to do with the commercial values of television. You can't have an unentertaining candidate because the press needs to make money, so they will unconsciously gravitate towards somebody who does what Trump does, which is he gets hits and eyeballs and ratings. And so he was sort of a perfect storm for the TV format that is the campaign show.
You write, and I know you supported Bernie Sanders in the campaign, and I would have supported Bernie if he didn't run as a Democrat. I mean, my problem is the Democratic Party, and I think your skepticism about it functioning as a viable party is probably close to mine. But you write that the public has been so split up and atomized for so long that real grassroots politics isn't really possible.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think, ironically, Trump is sort of proving that wrong. Although, what he did wasn't really grassroots politics. He was sort of a top-down media phenomenon. He was a consumer phenomenon, if anything. The Bernie phenomenon was really interesting because he was somebody who doesn't work for television. I mean, he's got all the opposite values of what
they want.
Well,
that's why the TV didn't run him.
Exactly.
Because he got up and spoke about policy and unemployed workers and
inequality and all the things that are actually taboo in our society. But he succeeded anyway, which to me suggests that there's this tremendous amount of energy out there. And some of it doesn't have to be political. Some of it is just a sense that he's not full of it like other politicians are. And that is the same thing that Trump tapped into. Even though he's a complete liar, he came across as more genuine than other politicians were. And Sanders had that same thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the tragedy, of course, when we look back on this period of history, because I don't know what your feeling is, but I think that if the Democrats had, if Sanders had won, and I think the Democrats really, there's plenty of evidence to support the, including, of course, dark money and campaign cash for Clinton, I think he would have beat Trump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that not because I like Bernie Sanders better than Hillary Clinton, but because I continually ran into people on the campaign trail who were Republicans who liked Bernie Sanders. Now, I didn't understand that at first because Bernie's an avowed socialist and he's just theoretically the Satan incarnate. But what they liked about him is that he was who he appeared to be.
He's honest.
He's honest, and they respect that.
In a bizarre kind of way. So is Trump. I think he actually believes all these conspiracy theories. I think he's
absolutely
kind of that.
Yeah.
That's kind of... I want to talk about the alt-right, the rise of Bannon. And you write a little bit about that in your book, about racial holy war. And you say, Trump's rebellion was born at the intersection of two toxic American myths, the post-racial society and the classless society. What are you saying there? And then tell me a little bit about the alt-right.
Well, first of all, I was slow on the draw with the alt-right for kind of an obvious reason, which is that they weren't visible very much on the campaign trail. The people who came to Donald Trump's campaign events, by and large, were not alt-righters. They, the alt-right self-consciously described itself as, we're the smart people, we went to college, and they see this other constituency as somebody they're simpatico with, the so-called white working class. But they think of themselves like the Leninist vanguard of that party. So you don't see them on the campaign. They're not in force out there. So I didn't recognize it until Bannon started to came on the scene and I had to learn about it. And then that was the moment where I thought this is really dangerous because, Trump is an idiot.
You signal it in the book where you suddenly go to rallies and Trump is talking about the plight of African Americans to white farmers or something in Iowa.
Yeah.
And that's where you become cognizant of Bannon.
Right, because Trump... Trump is almost incapable physically of reading prepared remarks and doing things by rote, but Bannon had him doing that, and it seemed preposterous at the time because it was, you know, on its
well,
on
you
its
talk
face,
about everybody people were just sort of sat there waiting for the punchline. There wasn't one.
Yeah, we were waiting. Like, where is this going? And but it was brilliant in retrospect.
Why?
Because what Bannon was doing was he looked at the map. He understood if we get all the Republican votes, Hillary is a terrible candidate, we're going to win. And all we have to do that is signal to these people, these quote-unquote moderate Republicans who are queasy about Trump's racism.
Who don't wear white hoods.
Exactly. who keep it in the trunk, right? We have to make it acceptable for those people to vote for Trump. And so they trotted Trump out there and were all but pulling the strings on his chin to make him say these things. And it worked, you know, and that was when I realized it was scary, because if you wed a strategic mind to Donald Trump, then that's when you get an incredibly destructive force. And we're seeing it now.
Yeah. Classless society.
Right, yeah.
I mean, you talk about that in the book, that there is no class, to quote Marx, consciousness.
Right.
On the part of the proletariat or the lumpen proletariat.
On either side, and our inability to talk about class, I think, contributed to the Trump phenomenon, because when it started to happen, everybody was slow to recognize what was going on. You know, they wanted to talk about this as a conservative, John Birch type of situation. Well, it wasn't that. This was about us versus them, right? And who's the us and who's the them? And it was very clear to reporters out on the trail, because we were the them, you know, yeah. and we know who we are. It's a bunch of effete college-educated people who live in New York, L.A., and Washington. Yeah. We're the bad guys, and it's everybody else out there who Trump was talking to. And it was clearly a class issue, but we were incapable of talking about it because it's taboo. In America.
Let's just close by talking about where you think this is going. I mean, you study, I think it's a great kind of character analysis of Trump. What do you think we're going to see?
I think it depends a lot on whether the Republican, the old Republican Party decides to throw in their lot with him, because he's a completely uncontrolled, you know, narcissist. He has no self-awareness, no conception of what he's actually doing. So he won't stop. I mean,
the New York Times had an editorial, President Bannon question.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, but he has this figure behind him.
Absolutely. From what we understand now, it's Bannon, that creepy, cadaverous-looking character, Stephen Miller, and Trump, the three of them sitting around cooking up all these crazy executive orders.
I used to worry about Giuliani and Christie.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I mean, those people are like, I don't even know. It's like Sally Struthers compared to these guys. And it's scary. You know, they're testing the limits of executive power. They're going to see what they can get away with. And they kind of remind me of O.J.'s lawyers. You know what I mean? They're playing a different game than everybody else, and they're stretching the rules as far as they can. And, that's how an authoritarian situation happens, is when you...
And it happens fast,
exactly. And it's always because people are too slow to react,
right,
and too slow to realize. Yeah.
Well, it is a brilliant book, all your books.
Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. Yeah. That was Matt Taibbi, author of Insane Clown President. In an age of images and entertainment, in an age of instant emotional gratification, we do not seek reality. Reality is complicated. Reality is boring. We are incapable or unwilling to handle this confusion. We ask to be indulged and comforted by cliches, stereotypes, and inspirational messages that tell us we can be whoever we seek to be, that we live in the greatest country on earth, that we are endowed with superior moral and physical qualities, and that our future will always be glorious and prosperous, either because of our own attributes or our national character, or because we are blessed by God. Reality is not accepted as an impediment to our desires. Reality does not make us feel good. And because we unplugged ourselves from reality, we elected a president who insists that reality is whatever he claims it to be. Thank you.
Well, there are some people on the left that know what's going on, even though we disagree on several points. And there's some people on the right that know what's going on. But not enough. Not enough. And not enough racial separatists know the right score and explore and look around for answers to the problems. They just keep going down the same old road because they've always got false leaders hanging on, making money, having lots of fun. This is why I did not vote, and I haven't voted for several electoral circuses, and I'm not going to vote because I don't want to be used like a whore. And if you're voting and you don't know the score, you're looked upon as a whore by these people, the ruling class. Now, we all know the Republican Party is corrupt to the core, but for the wealthy class. And we know the Democrats are corrupt to the core, partially to the ruling class. Or the people who are Marxist types who want to help the capitalists take over like they did, like the capitalists helped the Leninists in Russia to take over. So you need to concentrate on other things. Survival in the coming years. Educating your children in the right way. Reading books that tell the truth. And like that. And prepare for whatever's coming down the road, if you can. But spending time worrying about what happens on a day-to-day basis with the Republicans or the Democrats, or now we've got Trump, he's going to save our ass, forget it. Forget it. That just makes you look stupid. I'm going to read from a book here, a booklet by G.L. LeBon. I think it was printed in the 60s. Let me look. 66. Entitled, Why Racial Integration is a Vicious Crime and Why It Will Destroy the United States If Not Repealed. Well, it's almost got that accomplished. Not only is the black race inferior to the white and yellow races, but the North American Indian, or red race, a smaller racial group, is also inferior. Of course, they're originally Mongols. They're Mongols. It has nothing to do with India. And they're not Native Americans. They came here from Mongolia. For centuries, the North American Indian, like the African Negro, inhabited a fabulously rich land and accomplished nothing. Like the Negro, they accomplished nothing today without the aid of the white man. The Indian population of 1492 was estimated around 900,000. By 1900, it had been ruthlessly reduced to about 235,000. It is estimated that 2.5 million of them were slaughtered in the 408 years between 1492 and 1900. There has been some increase in their number since 1900. There were no Negroes here when Columbus discovered America. 127 years later, they were imported as slaves in 1619 from the Dutch at Jamestown. So if you want to blame somebody, blame the Dutch. Their numbers have zoomed to over 21 million and are now increasing at 57% faster than whites. Now remember, this is written in 66. If anyone were to suggest that the American Negro population be reduced by the same methods that were used to reduce and almost exterminate the American Indian population, he would probably be put in a padded cell. Let us take a look at the accomplishments of some of the black, white, and yellow nations. Haiti, black race, with a thriving economy for several centuries under the French. Negroes, led by a smarter-than-average Negro named Toussaint Louverture, massacred and drove out the French in 1804. Napoleon was too busy in Europe to bother about Haiti. Today, Haiti has sunk to a semi-savage state. It still is. Its foreign trade about half of what it was in 1804, when 800 of the 900 ships were required to handle its exports and foreign trade. A few years ago, Negro President Duvalier expelled the Catholic priests and the bishops when they criticized his reversion to voodooism. Liberia, black race, founded about 1820 for ex-slaves, has accomplished almost nothing without Firestone and U.S. help. 100 years later, in 1920, after World War I, the League of Nations sent an expedition to Liberia to stop smart Negroes from buying and selling their poor brothers. President Tubman built a multi-million dollar palace. It is surrounded by shacks. Currency is U.S. dollars. Whites cannot own land in Liberia by law. This is a continuation of the Monday show, which got interrupted due to conditions beyond my control. And it is February the 14th, Valentine's Day. Give your lady a kiss. Give your guy a kiss if you're a woman. Yeah, because this is the big day. This was Valentine's Day evolved from Rome. It's a pagan ritual. And that's fine. They used to sacrifice animals, and they'd cut skin from animals and dip them in blood. And then they'd chase the women down the street, and the men would throw these strips with blood at the women. And if you got hit with one of these bloody strips, that made their day. That was the big thing with the Roman women. So that's a little bit about history there. Things do change, especially when the favored race gets a hold of it and makes it a big money-making deal. Everything's got to be turned into making lots of money. All the holidays, yeah. Continuing, let's look at Ethiopia and the black race. Ethiopia has been an independent nation. This was years ago. What do they call it now? I forget what they call it now. It was an independent nation for 3,000 years, or about 1,000 years before the mythical Christ. Although twice the size of 1914 Germany and Japan, and fairly rich in natural resources, it has accomplished practically nothing. When Kennedy gave Haile Selassie a destroyer escort for a yacht, it was necessary to send to Norway for the entire crew. Not one Negro in Ethiopia was qualified, although it has a larger coastline than Germany. A few years ago, when some opposition elements tried to overthrow the conquering Lion of Judah, Haile Selassie, who had been dictator for about 40 years, they were hanged in public square and left hanging for a week. Their only railroad from Addis Ababa to Djibouti was 487 miles, and it was built by the French. A competent African authority, Robert Rourke, said Selassie has slaves, real slaves, in his gold mines. Selassie is the man who comes to the UN, prattles about democracy, criticizes segregation here and in South America. Late UN reports say over 200,000 black slaves are now in Central Africa, enslaved by Negroes and Arabs, not whites. Israel is about 20 years Zionist Jews built a modern city, Tel Aviv, irrigated a barren land, and built the first-class nation in an area about the size of New Jersey. While around them and elsewhere in Africa, Arabs, Negroes continued in indolent squalor. While Jews advocate integration here, there are no Negroes in Israel, especially in the Israeli army. And that, of course, that's changed somewhat. But when I was in Israel last year, I don't remember seeing any Negroes. I didn't. And remember that the tremendous infusion of German Jewish blood into Israel is what put them on top. European white Jews. They're more, a hell of a lot more white than they are non-white. That's for sure. And, of course, it helps when you're getting $3 to $4 billion a year, at least, from the United States government, the white people of America. Japan, the yellow race. You know, it's strange because in my travels in Japan, a lion's share of Japanese people were not yellow. They had a white skin, actually whiter than mine. So the women in Tokyo shopping and walking down the street, they had very, very white, almost a white powder skin. So that yellow race situation, I don't think is very accurate. Opened up by Perry in 1854, in 50 years, the Japanese developed a group of earthquake typhoon-ridden volcanic islands, much smaller than Texas. Texas is 262,000 square miles. Japan is 147,000 square miles. With a fraction of Texas' natural resources into the industrial powerhouse of Asia, built a modern army and navy and defeated huge Russia on land and sea in 1904. Japan leads the world in shipbuilding. Of the world's 21,000 ocean-going vessels listed in Lloyd's Register, London, over 2,000 were built in Japan. Not one was ever designed and built by Negroes. They built the world's largest ship, Tokyo Maru, 150,000 tons versus U.S. largest Manhattan, 106,000. At this time, when this was written, they were building a 200,000-ton ship over twice the size of the Queen Elizabeth and built 150 miles per hour trains, the world's fastest. And I rode on those trains. I rode on a train the length of Japan. It was the smoothest ride I've ever had on a train and fastest ride I've ever had on a train. And we can't even build one from L.A. to Las Vegas. For the Olympic Games, Japanese and Chinese are building their own nuclear reactors. Well, how's that working out for you? Anybody ever hear of the Negroes building trains, ships, or reactors? There's not even a bicycle factory in Ethiopia after 3,000 years. When Defense Secretary McNamara tried to enforce the infamous G-cell race-mixing report in Japan, they said Negroes may be as good as you Americans, but they are not as good as us. And that's what I ran into when I was in Japan on two occasions. Everywhere I went, they said, "Why do you put up with these Negroes? We wouldn't do it over here." But I think now, due to propaganda and so forth, there's a lot more of them getting into Japan. And of course, most of that started with the U.S. troops after World War II race mixing all over Japan. It says right here about that. Offspring of U.S. Wait a minute. Negroes, oh yeah. Offspring of U.S. occupation, Negro soldiers and Jap prostitutes are discriminated against. Many immigrate to Brazil. Many people forget Japan was our ally in World War I. Taiwan, yellow race. After 15 years, American help, Formosa, 12 million Chinese are self-supporting. U.S. economic aid ended in 1965. Germany, white race. Germany is one of the world's most brilliant nations and the backbone of what the white race along with the Anglo-Saxons. unsurpassed in science, culture, shipbuilding, engineering, and so on. Much of the U.S. scientific and cultural brilliance of German ancestry. The U.S. has two Germans running its space program, von Braun, the missile program, and Dornberger. If Germans are not superior to Negroes, why not have a couple of Negroes heading these programs? Negroes hardly knew what Negroes looked like until the U.S. Army arrived. Germans hardly looked what Negroes looked like until the U.S. Army arrived. Now there are 200,000 mulattoes in Germany. Well, there's a hell of a lot more than that now. As infamous and vicious a crime as Dachau, Buchenwald, and Auschwitz ever were, German doctors are quietly but steadily sterilizing mulattoes. Well, I don't think they made the grade there. The wealth and power of any nation depends on the intelligence and industry of its people. We'll ask Angela Merkel about that, who thrust a knife in the heart of Germany, racially. And the size of its natural resources, Iowa, 56,290 square miles, with some of the world's richest soil, can produce more agricultural products than Germany and Japan combined. These statistics are germane. California, 157,000 square miles. West Germany, as of 65, 95,000 square miles. Germany, 1914, 187,000 square miles. Japan, 147,000 square miles. Montana, 147,000 square miles. Texas, 262,000 square miles. USA, 3,022,000 square miles. England, 51,000 square miles. Russia, 8,358,000 square miles. If Germany and Japan had 3,022,000 square miles of rich natural resources, wouldn't they be peace-loving too? Hold it. In 1870, German Chancellor Bismarck gave British Prime Minister Gladstone a proposition to the effect that if England would give Germany free hand on the continent of Europe, Germany would give England a free hand in the rest of the world, i.e., England could keep India, Australia, Canada, South Africa, and other possessions. Germany wanted and desperately needed room for expansion. Lebensraum. Germany wanted to take the Ukraine away from the Russia and open a road to Baghdad. England turned the proposition down, although they had to go to Germany's Saxe-Coburg-Gotha for Prince Albert, for a husband for Victoria, to revitalize the British monarchy. Lebensraum was the principal underlying factor leading to World War I. One wonders how much prosperity there would have been in the USA today if there had been a force in the world in the 1800s to prevent our expansion westward, branded aggressors, and compelled us to live in an area a little over half the size of Texas. Well, I think that could have been achieved, possibly, peacefully, the move towards Russia. They already had a compact, and even though neither side liked it too much or trusted it, still it would have headed off millions of white people dying, hopefully. But England is always the agitator, and the problem is anytime anybody does anything on the continent of Europe, England wanted to control it. Whether that's all that led to World War II or not, but I know it was part of it. Hitler reminds me a little Trump. He fires from the hip, and Hitler firing from the hip in World War II is what brought the Third Reich down. When Woodrow Wilson was elected in 1912, millions were unemployed. By 1916, when he came up for a second term, the Depression had deepened and World War I had begun in Europe. Cotton was selling for 7.5 to 8 cents a pound, and wheat 95 cents a bushel. 9.7% of the labor force was unemployed, heavily weighted by Negroes. Today, 4% is considered too high. Wilson was reelected in 1916 on this his slogan, "I kept you out of war." He wasn't back in office 6 months before he was in the war. Lying propaganda began full blast. And that was the nephew of the big Jew, I forgot his name, that handled all that propaganda. It was Jewish propaganda from the very start. Horror stories of Germans cutting off women's breasts were circulated, just like they did against the Iraqis down in Kuwait. Posters to buy Liberty Bonds picturing German soldiers with Belgian babies on their bayonets were everywhere. Germany was called an autocracy. Germans were called Huns and Boches. The Kaiser was called the Beast of Berlin. Slogans such as "Make the world safe for democracy" and "Freedom of the seas" were broadcast, all to inflame the minds of the ignorant and impressionable. Young men like this writer ran down to a recruiting office to volunteer against these barbarians. After the war, humorist Irvin Cobb, Vice Admiral William S. Sims, U.S. Navy, and Earl Grey, British Foreign Minister, among others, exposed it all as lying propaganda to get the U.S. in the war to save England and France. The Germans did not commit those atrocities in World War I. Skin divers in 1964 disclosed the Lusitania carried arms and ammunition to kill Germans when torpedoed. Wilson got in the war to save American bankers who had loaned England and France hundreds of millions of dollars. And guess who most of those bankers were? The Germans had the Allies on the ropes because he had no solution for unemployment, aggravated by millions of Negroes and mechanization, except putting half the unemployed in the army and the other half in war plants to generate the economic and activity and prosperity. Then came the gangster-ridden Roaring Twenties with the Harding, Nan Britton, Gaston Means, Teapot Dome, and other sordid scandals, all of which culminated in the crash of 29. There were around 17 million unemployed, heavily Negro, when FDR took over in 1933. Thousands of farms and businesses were going bankrupt, factories closing, machinery rusting. Headlines were miles long, veterans selling apples on the street corners, banks failing by the scores. In New York City, office buildings and hotels were locked up 10 and 20 floors. Major General John C. Lejeune, Commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps, was approached by a group of powerful bankers and businessmen to lead a coup d'etat, oust Roosevelt, and take over the government in Washington. He declined. The country was on the verge of disintegration and revolution, exactly what we're headed for. Huey Long's Share the Wealth and Howard Scott's Technocrats and Townsend's Old Age Pension Plan and Upton Sinclair's EPIC in Poverty in California and other similar movements were spreading like wildfire. Actually, all these plans were a socialist and a nationalist, so that really, it was National Socialism was on the move peacefully in the United States at that time. When President Hoover was advised it was necessary to go off the gold standard, he exclaimed in horror, quote, "If we ever go off the gold standard, grass will grow in the streets." His successor went off, and the country has had more prosperity than ever before in history. After 2 terms dawdling with various nostrums such as repealing prohibition, WPA, NRA, CCC, and so on, there were still around 10 million unemployed when FDR announced for the unprecedented third term in 1940. Many of his closest associates, such as John Nance Garner, Raymond Moley, James A. Farley, and others, broke with him. They finally realized he was a cunning, power-crazy man, determined to perpetuate himself in the presidency. Regardless, the sage advice of George Washington that no president should serve over two terms. The people made a terrible blunder when they did not repudiate him in 1940. The nation was bankrupt of organized, constructive leadership. Like Wilson, FDR was reelected on a platform of keeping the nation out of war. On October 30, 1940, a few days before the election, he made a speech in Boston saying, quote, "I say to you again and again and again, under no circumstances will American boys be sent to foreign shores." At that very moment, he was working secretly with Churchill to involve this country and had American destroyers shooting at German submarines in the Atlantic. This is why I keep telling you, boys and girls, there's no really good leaders, no leaders, no presidents that you can trust. They always are screwing you behind the scenes. You have to remember that. Under this system, it's going to go on that way until the end. Frederick Oxner, Berlin correspondent for United Press, wrote from there in April 1941 that there, quote, "are no slums or tenements in Germany," unquote. Hitler had abolished them in five years, and there were no Negroes in Germany. On November 26, 1941, 10 days before Pearl Harbor, FDR gave Japan an ultimatum to get out of Indochina, Manchuria, Formosa, and other places recognized Chungking, and get back on their own islands, which he had no right to do. He also froze their assets. An ultimatum is the equivalent of a declaration of war, and Japan took it as such. A look at the statistics would convince anyone that Japan needed and still needs room for expansion, and at the time they needed oil, and they were being denied oil by England, France, and the United States. As a result of Wilson and FDR involving us in two wars in which we should never have been involved, destroying the expansionist aims of Japan and Germany, which had some merit in view of our own record, we are now compelled to protect them both from communism. Both are relieved of huge, and I might say also capitalism. They talk about communism. The fight against communism was a diversion, a needed diversion, but it took the attention away from the sins of capitalism. Both are relieved of huge military expenditures. We're over a barrel of our own design. Washington's advice in his farewell address: stay out of foreign entanglements because their quarrels are eternal and will never be settled. Sort of sounds like North Africa, right? Is just as sound today as when given. There always will be. Cuba, Cyprus, Berlin, Vietnam, Korea, Suez, Middle East, Congo, Panama, Santo Domingo should be sufficient warning that Washington was right and that we are on the road to economic, if not military, disaster. Clara Booth Luce said FDR lied to us in the war. And he did. Westbrook Pegler, John T. Flynn, Charles A. Beard, and others exposed FDR's machinations and hypocrisy. Over 3,000 Americans were killed at Pearl Harbor. Someone should have been shot for that. Why were General Short and Admiral Kimmel never court-martialed, if they were guilty? Why have FDR's papers never been published and have probably been destroyed? FDR was hypnotized by Stalin, called him good old Joe. Even Churchill was alarmed and protested to no avail. Henry Morgenthau, Jr., FDR's Secretary Treasurer, proposed removing all factories from Germany, making it an agricultural or pastoral state. Could anyone imagine anything more completely insane? Only the superb foresight and statesmanship of General MacArthur prevented a calumny in Asia. If he had been in command in Europe, there could have been little likelihood of Britain, the Berlin mess today. If Wilson had followed the advice of Washington and the founders and had not involved this country in World War I, there would have been no Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, fascism, or communism, or World War II. In fact, you can lay that primarily at the feet of the Jews, that they were very, very much involved in the World War I situation, making money, and then the Jew bankers, the Warburgs, and all of those people, Rothschilds and so forth. So essentially, the Jew involvement in pre-World War I and during World War I opened the door for Hitler. So when the Jews complained about Hitler, what are they talking about? They helped create him. It is the people's fault for not living up to their duty and responsibilities. Well, they're lazy. They always were. No time in history have they not been lazy, keeping themselves reliably informed. Well, how can you be reliably informed when all the news media are lying bastards and fake news? All they do is put out fake news. And rejecting FDR when he proposed running for a third term, the great man who founded this nation provided the instruments for removal of those who should be rejected and removed, i.e. the ballot and impeachment. Well, we see that doesn't work. No matter what we do at the ballot box, the same crooks, same type of crooks, just keep leading the country. So what are you going to do? I know what we should do, and ultimately it will have to do if we're going to survive. The majority of people have been too stupid, weak, uninformed, indifferent, greedy, disorganized, and misled to use these weapons intelligently as they should. Well, that's the end of the reading for today, and I think this is a pretty good little book. I've got all these old books that are just as good today as they were when they were printed and written, maybe in the 20s and the 30s and right on up. Well, happy Valentine's Day, all you she-wolves out there, and Terrible Tommy's going to... I already gave my lady a big box of turtle candy. I never heard of it. She says it's great. And a great big heart box, so she's happy. But she's not fat. Okay, see you later.
Make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on last gristle.
That grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the right side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow. So always look on the bright side.
side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep them laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And
always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life.
Come on, thank you.
Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life.
First things happen to see, you know.
Always look on the bright side of life.
You know, you've come from nothing, you've gone back to nothing. What are you lost?
Always look on the bright side of life.
Nothing will come from nothing. Incidentally, this record's available
always
in the foyer.
Someone's
got to live as well,
right?
What do you think pays for this, Robinson?
Always look on the money back, you know?
I told him. I said to him, Bernie, I said, they'll never make that money back.
The wrong dressing room, and I couldn't find any place to put my stuff. And I don't know how you are, but I need a place to put my stuff. So that's what I've been doing back there, just trying to find a place for my stuff. You know how important that is. That's the whole meaning of life, isn't it? Trying to find a place for your stuff. That's all your house is. Your house is just a place for your stuff. If you didn't have so much goddamn stuff, you wouldn't need a house. You could just walk around all the time. That's all your house is. It's a pile of stuff with a cover on it. You see that when you take off in an airplane and you look down and you see everybody's got a little pile of stuff. Everybody's got their own pile of stuff. And when you leave your stuff, you got to lock it up. Wouldn't want somebody to come by and take some of your stuff. They always take the good stuff. They don't bother with that crap you're saving. Ain't nobody interested in your fourth grade arithmetic papers. They're looking for the good stuff. That's all your house is. It's a place to keep your stuff while you go out and get more stuff. Now, sometimes you've got to move. You've got to get a bigger house. Why? Too much stuff. You've got to move all your stuff. And maybe put some of your stuff in storage. Now imagine that. There's a whole industry based on keeping an eye on your stuff. Enough about your stuff. Let's talk about other people's stuff. Did you ever notice when you go to somebody else's house, you never quite feel 100% at home? You know why? No room for your stuff. Somebody else's stuff is all over the place. And what awful stuff it is. Where did they get this stuff? And if you have to stay overnight at someone's house, you know, unexpectedly, and they give you a little room to sleep in that they don't use that often, someone died. And they haven't moved any of his stuff. Or wherever they give you to sleep, usually right near the bed there's a dresser and there's never any room on the dresser for your stuff. Someone else's shit is on the dresser. Have you noticed that their stuff is shit and your shit is stuff? Get that off of there. Now, sometimes you go on vacation. You gotta bring some of your stuff with you. You can't bring all your stuff. Just the stuff you really like. The stuff that fits you well that month. Let's say you're gonna go to Honolulu. You're gonna go all the way to Honolulu. You gotta take two big bags of stuff. Plus your carry-on stuff, plus the stuff in your pockets. You get all the way to Honolulu and you get in your hotel room and you start to put away your stuff. That's the first thing you do in a hotel room is put away your stuff. I'll put some stuff in here, put some stuff down there. Here's another place for some stuff here. I'll put some stuff over there. You put your stuff over there. I'm putting my stuff over here. Here's another place for some stuff. Hey, we got more places than we've got stuff. We're going to have to buy more stuff. Yeah. Now,
And you put all your stuff away, and you know that you're thousands of miles from home, and you don't quite feel at ease, but you know that you must be okay because you do have some of your stuff with you. And you relax in Honolulu on that basis. That's when your friend from Maui calls and says, "Hey, why don't you come over to Maui for the weekend? Spend a couple of nights over here." "Oh, shit, no. Now what stuff do you bring?" "Right, you've got to bring an even smaller version of your stuff. Just enough stuff for a weekend on Maui." And you get over, and you're really spread out now. You've got shit all over the world. You've got stuff at home, stuff in storage, stuff in Honolulu, stuff in Maui, stuff in your pocket. Supply lines are getting longer and harder to maintain. But you get over to your friend's house in Maui, and they give you a little place to sleep, and there's a little window ledge or some kind of a small shelf, and there's not much room on it, but it's okay because you don't have much stuff now. And you put what stuff you do have up there. You put your imported French toenail clippers, your odor readers with the 45-day guarantee, your cinnamon-flavored dental floss, and your Afrin 12-hour decongestant nasal spray. And even though you're a long way from home, you know that you must be okay because you do have your Afrin 12-hour decongestant nasal spray. And you relax in Maui on that basis. That's when your friend says, "Hey, I think tonight we'll go over the other side of the island and stay at my friend's house overnight." "Oh, shit, no. Now what do you bring?" Now you just bring the things you know you're going to need. Money, keys, comb, wallet, lighter, hanky, pen, cigarettes, contraceptives, Vaseline, whips, chains, whistles, dildos, and a book.